KMO Show episode number 30, Sunday, March 23rd, 2025.
You are listening to the KMO Show. I'm KMO, and I am joined by somebody who approached me via Substack, which is my only social media really these days. And I'm not sure how he wants to be identified, so I will just say, guest, please speak about yourself for a bit.
Sure. So thanks for having me on the pod. My name is Kevin, and I currently co-host a podcast of my own called Synthesized Sunsets, which has an accompanying Substack. And on the podcast, we talk about a lot of stuff related to speculative fiction and also the evolution of popular culture and kind of like where we see that going. And also what we talk a lot about what sorts of media may rise and fall as we kind of just like, you know, hurtle into this new world of AI and algorithms. Our most recent, I would say that the articles that we write are usually along those lines, but we also have a lot of articles that are sort of like reflecting on childhood. So it'll be about some childhood experience and how that relates to some work of speculative fiction we'll be reading or something along those lines. And so I would say that we're still kind of trying to find our identity as a publication and a podcast, but it's been pretty fun so far. And so we're interested to see how it's going to go. You were one of the, you're one of the people to restack one of our more recent posts. And so I just thought it'd be a good opportunity to kind of talk about that and also other things.
Well, what post was that?
That post was 17776 by John Boyce and the slow cancellation of the future.
And just in very brief terms, what's the topic there? What is that long number?
Right, sure. So 17776 is a, in my opinion, actually, one of the more significant, one of the most significant works of science fiction in the 21st century. And it's this book by, well, book, it's a stretch. It is this narrative by a like a sports writer named John Boyce that is like very multimedia. So when you read it on the internet, it starts off as like this article, and then it turns into like a calendar, and then it turns into almost like this play script. And you just have all these things like GIFs and videos and text interacting in this very crazy way that wouldn't have really been possible that long before it was published. And I remember reading it, and I really thought that it was a sign of what was to come in the landscape of speculative fiction. Like, I was like, okay, this is a sign that we have moved beyond just like the paradigms of text and video, and the new science fiction is going to be stuff that's, you know, in like these multimedia forms that we're not familiar with, and some stuff that's going to have to develop as we get more familiar with it. But you know, since that work came out, which I believe was in 2017, I would say that the opposite has happened. Like, we've kind of just, as a society, doubled down on text and video as a society on the internet. And I think this has been a real shame, because I just feel like the internet, like, is not like as kind of like explosive and vibrant and novel as it used to be. And in this article, I try to tie this into the ideas of Mark Fisher, who is this this left-wing sociologist, his main idea was called the slow cancellation of the future, which is basically this idea that in the 20th century, especially the first half of the 20th century, people had all of these different novel ideas of what future they want to live in and what society might look like, you know, decades, centuries down the line. Whereas in the latter half of the 20th century, and especially the 21st century, the future has sort of unceremoniously faded away. And now when people think about the future, they kind of just imagine like a similar sort of dystopian world that hasn't really changed much. And there's been a lack of vision in terms of imagining what comes next. And he has a lot of different reasons for this, but to me, these two topics are just very intimately related.
Well, the crossover audience between my podcasting efforts and those of Doug Lane, who's a friend of mine and somebody who's a ideological leftist, but somebody who criticizes the left from the left, they will definitely recognize the name Mark Fisher. In addition to the slow cancellation of the future, he's, I think, best known for the notion of capitalist realism. I think he had a book by that title. And also Exiting the Vampire Castle. He was one of the first people on the left to criticize leftist cancel culture. And the people that he was criticizing, you know, responded unkindly and with such intensity and just unbroken, you know, relentlessness. I don't know. I can't draw an exact causal connection, but he did kill himself after that. So yeah, Mark Fisher, definitely a name worth knowing if you don't already. So early on, like when you first approached me, you mentioned your age as an enticement for talking to you. So you probably don't talk to many Generation Z guys. And no, I don't. I mean, I have two sons of mine, but they don't tell me everything. And you mentioned your childhood. My childhood was in the 1970s, and my adolescence and most of my teen years were in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Actually, all of my teen years were in the 1980s. And the 70s and the 80s have distinct characters. Like, you wouldn't confuse one for the other. Just the visual images that go with each decade are unique. You know, they don't overlap much, even though, of course, there is a transition between one to the next. And yet, that pattern of decades having distinct characters seems to have broken down in the 21st century. Like, 2006, my mental images of it are not that different from 2016. And as a Gen Z man, I wonder what your perspective on that is.
Right, yeah. I think this is a really interesting point. I would say that I'm definitely less of that view than most people, but this is definitely a common thing that people bring up. One of my favorite discussions of this particular idea, Mark Fisher, there's this podcast called by a guy named Joshua Citarella, who's just sort of like this interesting leftist thinker who has pretty heterodox people come onto his show. And he had this discussion with actually a pretty famous musician, Mattie Healy of the 1975. And I did not expect, I generally don't have a high opinion or very high expectations for what some musician is going to think about, you know, politics and culture, but it was actually just a really, really high level of discourse. And they spent a lot of time on this topic in particular. Mattie Healy was contending that, you know, decades don't have as distinctive an identity anymore, and kind of just everything doesn't have as distinctive an identity anymore. He was talking about how in the past, 70s, 80s, and 90s, subcultures were sort of just people in certain subcultures were just sort of visually recognizably of that subculture. Like, if you were to kind of see a group of punks, you're just like, oh yeah, you know, or like a group of goth kids or a group of, I don't know. I mean, I'm too young. I don't really know the stock subculture super well. But like, if you saw a group of kids out, you would kind of just know like what sort of subculture they're a part of. Whereas nowadays, if you see a group of kids, like, I don't know, they're kind of just like dressing whatever and they act like whatever. And he saw this as like a great loss. I would say that to me, like different, you know, different decades definitely have a different aesthetic, but I feel like the visual aspect of this aesthetic is so much less pronounced, especially in like the real world. So something that Mattie Healy talks about is how, like, in each decade of music, like just the paradigm shift from like, you know, an electric guitar to like synthesizers was crazy. Like nothing, like there were just a lot of things that you couldn't translate and just entire new things that had to be invented. And just like even visually, like going from like the electric guitar to like the computer and like machines was just like a big step. But now all the paradigm shifts occur like within this frame of the computer. So you might have some interesting new paradigm shift related to the sounds that are used in your music. But like, it's just going to be like, oh yeah, this one computer thing to this other computer thing. And so when you have all these things being mediated within like the frame of computers, I feel like it's harder to, you know, take in those, you know, distinct aesthetic impressions.
When it comes to music, I don't really have the vocabulary to describe this in much detail, but it is my understanding that in the music world today, in terms of very popular music, there is just a handful of producers who are producing everything. And any given pop song is going to have a whole team of producers who assembled it. You know, each has their own specialty, you know, crafting, you know, little pieces of hooks and little tiny snippets of dialogue. And, you know, one reason why there's just not that much distinctiveness is there are fewer people actually producing the creative element. You know, it is a very closed shop, much like the internet has become a very closed shop in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that's a mostly accurate. Well, it's hard to say because I feel like music has always been pretty like kind of like an oligopoly. I will say that like I think probably something that's more pronounced than there being less producers is that there are less labels. You know, like you have like it used to be that the music that was popular on the radio would come from this, you know, wide array of labels. You know, you have like Polydor and Republic and Interscope, but you know, these are kind of just all being congealed into like, you know, three or four different gigantic megacorps that but yeah, you know, are kind of just not really like that's going to have an effect, you know, bringing all these different labels under one roof, even if they're supposed to have their own different feel and vibe. And so, yeah, there is a certain sameness in pop music. I mean, I would just, I just want to say that I'm like a pretty big admirer of pop music in the sense that I see pop music as kind of like this cultural technology that's being improved every year. Like, I think it's just kind of being more and more and more optimized towards this ideal. And this is sort of like technologically cool to me, even though on some level, I think there are some levels on which it's kind of like, you know, repulsive, that it's like engineered to this degree, but just kind of from like a more technological sci-fi perspective, I find it to be very cool.
You know, the notion that decades would lose their distinctiveness seems at odds with the fact that technology changes quite a bit. You would think that you could look for technological clues to a particular decade, and you can, but it's just they don't jump out. Like, did you ever see the first Zoolander movie with Ben Stiller as the fashion model?
I'm not, unfortunately.
Well, it's a parody, and in it, he's a very shallow fashion model. And this was before smartphones came out. And the trend in the pre-smartphone, you know, mobile phone era was for phones to get increasingly smaller. And Zoolander's phone was like a prize out of a Cracker Jack box. It was a tiny, tiny little thing. It was impossibly small. You know, there were no phones that small at the time, but that was the gag, you know, that this New York fashion model has got the latest phone and it's tiny. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen anymore. I mean, iPhones, it used to be that, you know, you could look at a movie and you would be shocked at how big somebody's phone was. And that's because, oh yeah, that's from 5 years ago, you know, when phone technology was very different than it is now. And an iPhone from today, you know, at a glance doesn't look much different from an iPhone from 5 years ago. So that those sorts of distinctions don't leap out like they used to. But at the same time, it's weird because particularly with AI, I mean, technology is moving quite a bit, but particularly in science fiction for the screen, you know, where you don't you have less scientific rigor and less speculative emphasis. And, you know, it's more just sort of tropes and visual markers of science fiction that TV and movie writers employ. They don't seem to be keeping up with AI. And also there is, you know, a 2, 3, sometimes 4 and 5 year production pipeline. So people are writing things who, you know, might understand how AI as it's manifesting in the world now is different from how science fiction authors had imagined it in the past. They might be incorporating that into their scripts now, but we won't see those scripts for a while. And so, you know, by the time that updated information about how real AI works filters into science fiction entertainment, AI will have moved on considerably since then. And yet I kind of anticipate that this lack of distinction between time periods will continue. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. I think that especially in the domain of movies, it's just kind of striking how much recycling happens. You know, like, I think that if you're not as plugged into sci-fi literature in particular, then it's maybe not as visible, but just more and more and more, like, every single sci-fi property on screen is just adapted from some, you know, pretty old property, or just recycling these tropes that should be common to any, like, big consumer of sci-fi, or both. Like, I remember I recently saw Mickey 17 in theaters, and it was just, like, so striking to me how many elements of these films were just recognizably of other science fiction properties. Like, these aliens show up who just look incredibly similar to the aliens in Nazca of the Valley of the Wind from, like, the 1970s. And then, you know, it's based off of this pre-existing novel. And, you know, it's about this guy who just, like, dies a bunch of times and comes back to life. It's just like, wow, I've never seen that before. And I think that I do wonder, like, is the movie industry going to, like, eventually they're gonna stop running out of these big sweeping sci-fi narratives to adapt, right? There are only so many Dunes, and so I kind of wonder, like, will that happen, you know, or will people just kind of be satisfied to kind of just get these sci-fi films that are just regurgitated forms of everything else that has already come before it?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to go with that. But for the non-film geeks, I want to point out that Mickey 17, which I have not seen, is directed by Bong Joon-ho, who directed Parasite and Snowpiercer and an older, really fun horror movie called, what was the one with the monster in the bay? What was that?
Not familiar. I think I've only seen Memories of Murder and the ones you mentioned.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, he's visually a very creative director, you know, a bold director. Oh, he also did a movie for Netflix called Okja, which was about...
Oh, right. I've seen Okja as well.
Yeah. Well, for those who haven't, it's about a genetically engineered, like, hippopotamus that is being raised for meat. But it's cute and smart, and it's a, you know, don't eat meat propaganda sort of film. Uh-huh. And what I've heard about Mickey 17 is that it is pretty heavy-handed in terms of the progressive messaging, which is required in Hollywood films today. And because of the long production pipeline, it does not reflect the recent vibe shift. And so it really stands out as being, you know, sort of oppressive and heavy-handed in that way. I wonder if that vibes with your impression of the film.
Yeah, I mean, the social commentary, like, it was just so underwhelming to me. Like, I mean, okay, like, in fairness, this movie was supposed to come out 2 years ago. Even 2 years ago, though, I think a lot of the social commentary would have felt dated. But, like, I'm just like, man, it's 2025 and we're still, like, I mean, I don't want to, like, spoil the film, but it was just so, so on the nose. And that was something I was pretty disappointed by, because I feel like in most of Bong's films, the social commentary is pretty, like, you know, like, kind of interesting and subversive. Certainly in Parasite, but also in Memories of Murder, like, the takeaway is not so simple. But, you know, after Mickey 17, I was kind of just like, okay, yes, this is what the director wants me to think.
Well, it's funny, you know, that we were just a few minutes ago, we're talking about how the different decades don't look or sound all that distinct. And yet when it comes to political messaging in films, it's like, oh man, that's so 5 years ago, you know, like there are distinct eras and distinct shifts in, you know, in how people are thinking and communicating and articulating themselves.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. I mean, I think that, just like on a meta level, like, I do think that it puts you in, like, a weird it puts you in a weird rhetorical position when you're kind of like, you know, on the left, but you just kind of disagree, like you disagree with like, you know, even like the didacticism of it all, or just like, or just like anything really, because like I just feel that there's a lot there, like there's kind of like a lot to attack. And so I think that it's if someone is kind of like on the left, it's very easy for them to kind of slide into this role of just like only criticizing the left, or just like, you know, them criticizing the left being a big chunk of what they do. And it's like, if you're in that position at a certain point, it's sort of just like, okay, but like, what are you trying to accomplish? Like, what is the goal of this? And I think this is often met with suspicion. And so I think that the, like the second order effect of this is that I think people are, I'm going to be charitable here and say that I do think part of modern left-wing cancel culture is a product of the fact that that like people are suspicious, you know, of your intentions, because there are like a lot of people who are kind of like purportedly left-wing, but as like the years go on and on and on, you kind of see that it was just like all a farce. And so I think that if you sort of have like, you know, these like left-wing bona fides, people would be a lot less likely to kind of like, you know, question your intentions like that. Although I'm certainly not going to go to bat for cancel culture or anything.
Well, some of my favorite Substack accounts are like Postcards from Barsoom by John Carter, Library of Celino or Celeno, Tree of Woe, Walt Bismarck. I mean, these are people that I would have described as alt-right, but now they're more dissident right, I guess is the current term. Alt-right was more sort of shock-oriented and transgressive for its own sake, whereas the dissident right is more intellectual and nuanced. And, you know, for somebody on the left who wants to present themselves, you know, as a public intellectual, well, yeah, you can criticize the left from the left. In a way, it's easier because you're already familiar with the left. To criticize the right from the left, you either have to pay attention to what the right vanguard is doing, which, as far as I can tell, there's very little appetite for doing so, or you just criticize a caricature of the right, which people who are on the right recognize as, you know, being completely, you know, just irrelevant to their actual concerns. But if you're going to, you know, make the effort and actually follow and internalize nuanced arguments by people that you expect to disagree with, you know, you got to know going into that very few of your intended audience members are going to follow you in that. So I mm-hmm. just don't see any real interesting criticism of the actual right from the left.
Mm-hmm. I actually think that, like, for me, I see cancel culture in its modern form as more of a product of, like, I guess what you would call in, like, I mean, this term has become so loaded now, but, like, liberalism, you know, like modern liberalism. I think that the left,
pause for a moment,
to their more modern,
and unpack your use of that, because that is a very big term.
Right. Okay. Sure. So, I mean, there's you can use the phrase liberal in many senses. There's sort of like this idea of the classical liberal, and then I feel like also you could use liberal in like the institutional sense, someone who's very pro-institution. But I think in modern American political discourse, liberal usually means like, you know, someone that's like on the left, but they're not quite a leftist, you know, I guess sort of like the modal Democratic Party member. And I think that when you compare someone who's, I guess, self-identifies as liberal versus someone who self-identifies the leftist, because leftists are kind of very reluctant to identify with the liberal label at all, in my experience, I would say that those on the left are definitely much much less wedded to cancel culture, much more willing to engage with the right in a substantive manner. Of course, this dynamic has changed a bit as left-wing thought has become like way, way more mainstream. Like, I think that just naturally, as a movement becomes more mainstream, its ideas become less nuanced and diluted. I guess I wouldn't have ever, like, I don't think I identify like, I guess, this reluctance to engage with like leftists specifically. I feel like if you like, I don't know if you're familiar with the, are you familiar with like the Dirtbag Left at all? Like,
I'm familiar Chapo with Trap the term. I never have been a, an appreciator of Chapo Trap House, but yeah, I interviewed Angela Nagel several years ago. I think she was considered a member of the Dirtbag Left. But yeah, I'm familiar with some of the names and some of the personalities, but it's not something I consume regularly.
Yeah, right. I mean, I wouldn't say that I consume the Dirtbag Left regularly either, but I think it's just kind of an example of, I feel like there has always been this tradition of engaging with the right. And I generally have seen that I feel like the right or the left, like, you know, I think the far left engages with the right, usually in like a more kind of nuanced and informed way than like the center left. I guess also, yeah, like I would also say that because like the right has kind of been like almost like sort of counterculture for a while, maybe not anymore, but I think that the movement that is in the counterculture is always going to be more intellectually generative. You know, like there's not really this institutional vision of what being on the right is. And like, I think that there are so many currents in the right wing that it's hard to know what's going on unless you're really plugged in. And so I think that honestly, especially after watching Mickey 17, I think there are a lot of liberals who still operate under this like, you know, 90s early aughts paradigm of what like what conservatives are and what Republicans are and what they stand for that just really isn't true anymore.
Science fiction. We're getting kind of political here. And while I certainly have political opinions, it's not my main ballywick these days. I write about science fiction and I say futurism, you know, with sort of tongue in cheek, because I think predictions of the future are, you know, accurate ones are quite rare and probably don't show up often in futurist discourse. They're more likely to show up in like economic discourse. Somebody always calls it right. So let's go back to sci-fi. A big frustration of mine is that, you know, as a teenager, I read a lot of print science fiction, loved it. And I work in a library now and I see that, you know, in your generation, at least people who depend on public libraries to get their books, young men don't read. They come in and they get on the computers or they check out DVDs or video games, but they don't check out books. Young women do check out books, and the science fiction, like the mainstream publishing end of science fiction, has shifted hard over into romanticy, graying into like, you know, erotica and what a fellow librarian calls book porn, because, you know, it doesn't have the stigma of full-on audiovisual porn that you'd get from the internet. So, you know, they can read it at home in front of their parents or read it wherever. And, you know, it's created an ugly feedback loop in that young women read books, young men don't. So the publishing industry, you know, if it has its ideological side, but just, you know, market forces alone would cause them to tailor their output for the people who are already spending money on their product, which is going to drive it further in the direction of appealing to women and driving away men. So I've been saying that on my blog quite a bit, so I'll stop and get your perspective.
Right. So yeah, I mean, there's kind of, yeah, there's a lot of stuff to respond to here. I mean, I think that you have this, like, I mean, first of all, it's certainly true. Like less men are reading books. And I guess like not to sound like a suburban mom, but I think a large part of it is the video games, you know, for like, you know, for sci-fi and fantasy in particular. I think that, a lot of men who would have been reading about these literary adventure fantasies in the past are now getting that same narrative feel from, or that same narrative experience from video games, only it's even more awesome because they get to partake in this narrative themselves. Like they don't just have to kind of imagine themselves in that world. And so I think that a lot of the narrative energy in terms of entertainment targeted towards men has moved towards video games. But I think that, it's also true that there are other things at work, you know, like there are all of these complicated feedback loops. When it comes to publishing, yeah, publishing has definitely moved in a more like, you know, a more like female direction. And there's many different stories you can tell about this, right? Like, one is you could say that it's like this ideological, you'd say it's ideologically motivated and the result of these like woke publishing houses. Another angle you could take is that it's market forces. And then there's other takes you take as well. Or you could say it's a combination of all of them. And I guess I'm pretty sympathetic to the argument that it's a combination of market forces, but then also there just being so many fewer publishing houses. I mean, the consolidation of publishing has just been a complete disaster, in my opinion. There's just like basically four or five publishing houses that publish essentially all the books that are popular in the United States. And I think that when you have that situation, you're more likely to have these market inefficiencies. Like, if you were to have a healthier ecosystem of medium-sized to small publishing houses that were writing books for other demographics, then I think that you would be less likely to see it as extreme as it is now. But because there's only like, you know, four companies that just really care about their bottom line, you just see a lot less variation in what's getting published. And I do expect that to change, but I do think that, you know, it is to some degree a product of like the consolidation of these like large corporations.
Apologies to whoever's argument I'm about to steal. Somebody presented this to me, and if I could remember who it was, I would credit them. But there's a principal agent problem in publishing, in that books tend to come to the attention of publishers via agents. And agents don't take the same financial risks that the publishers do. So while they are supposed to be representing the publisher's interests, in fact, they're really primarily engaged in managing their own social reputations amongst their peers. And so, you know, there came a point a few years ago when it was beyond not cool. It was simply just not done to buy the work of, you know, and this is from agents, you know, to buy or champion the work of emerging white male writers. You know, if your new protege was not in some consecrated demographic, you know, it just, in terms of the social standing of the people in that world, it just, you know, that didn't fly. And the fact that it was damaging the sales, you know, the financial returns of the publishers, didn't affect the agents directly. That's the, you know, the principal agent problem, where the agent is supposed to be representing the interests of the principal, and they don't. They represent their own interests. And I think, the, you know, the industry has adapted to that by leaning hard into book porn, you know, aimed at women. And part of it is in science fiction, and then, you know, part of it is just romance. This is kind of off topic, but there's a disturbing trend that I see just as a librarian, and it's that these very sexually explicit romance novels aimed at young women have covers that would be very appealing to children. You know, they're very cutesy, very simple looking covers, which is weird. And part of it is some of these authors started out writing young adult fiction, which was not sexually explicit, but the authors have aged, their audience has aged, and, you know, they and their audience are more interested in sexually explicit material. And so that doesn't explain why the publishers, because it's not the writer's choice to put a cutesy cover on a sexually explicit book. But, you know, it does explain the shift in content by the writers and readers, although not the behavior of the publishers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the simplest explanation is they've market tested things and that's what sells.
Yeah, just simple A/B testing. Yeah. No.
But yeah, I just feel like this is a pretty clear, I think this is a case where there is a pretty strong, like, you know, I think there's a pretty strong case to be made that publishing could be best improved through, like, you know, like a left-wing frame. You know, like, I think that it would be, I think it's hard to argue against the idea that the consolidation of publishing into these gigantic mega corporations has been a big contributor into like the flattening of the literature landscape. Because, like, yeah, I mean, if there were kind of like these more of these smaller publishers that could get work out there, then I think that the market would respond, you know, like there would be a market for those books. It wouldn't be as big as the market for, like, you know, erotica with cutesy covers, but it would still have a way of getting out there. But now that pretty much the only way to get your stuff out there is through these large mega corporations, then it is kind of just up to the, like, it's much more sensitive to, I guess, vibe shifts, as you could say.
Well, one thing we haven't mentioned is that, you know, we've been talking about changes in the publishing industry, but there are people who love science fiction, you know, from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and aughts, and they're still writing it, but, you know, the big publishers aren't publishing it, but they are. You can go on, you know, Kindle Direct Publishing and put your novel out. I've done that. Mm-hmm. I've talked to many other people who have done that. Amazon doesn't help with discovery. They don't show your book to anybody. you know, so you can sell copies to the whatever business you can drum up yourself. They will deliver. They will print and deliver the books, but they're not going to help you with marketing. And there's a couple different scenarios that can play out from this. You know, you mentioned what happens when Dune has been remade four times and all the good sci-fi properties from the past have been totally milked and the publishing industry isn't providing anything new, you know, that is suitable. There's a couple different things that can happen. The Hollywood studios can send their AI agents out into the internet and find all the stuff that people have been publishing, you know, outside of the mainstream publishing apparatus for the past decade. And, you know, option those books for films and TV and such, which would be great news for the people who have been struggling, you know, outside of the mainstream to keep their favorite genre alive and vital. Or the AI can just go out there, sample all the stuff that was never published and never really recognized, and just mine it for bits of vitality to take back to the Hollywood studios and not reward the people who struggled in, you know, in isolation and in, you know, in under hard circumstances with no, you know, no feedback, no encouragement, and no, you know, significant paycheck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that would certainly be kind of a dystopian outcome.
But not surprising.
I think, but certainly not surprising. Yeah, I don't know. It's, like, interesting. I feel like this is the case in both music and literature. Like, on some level, it's never been easier to release things out into the world. But also, at the same time, it's just, you know, never been harder to get, like, it's very hard to get, like, a medium number of eyeballs on something, if that makes sense. Like, you're either big or you're small, and I think that the age of the medium record label, the medium publishing house, is over. You know, it's about, like, yeah, either going through the mainstream channels or getting your you know, unexpected shot at virality. I saw actually a pretty interesting take on Substack recently. I really can't speak to how true it is, but this person was basically hypothesizing that they think that people perceive reading books as even more feminine than it actually is, because a lot of women have become very good at sort of marketing, like, books as lifestyle, if that makes sense. You know, like, both authors and readers being able to create a brand around their engagement with literature and, like, posting about it on social media in a way that's enticing and gets people excited to also partake in this activity. Whereas if you think of guys, like, I mean, the ratio of, like, I guess, female literary influencers to male literary influencers is probably, like, ridiculously high. And, like, I mean, it just kind of makes sense. Like, I feel like it's harder for me to imagine a guy doing that sort of thing.
Are you familiar with Book Talk?
Yeah, I'm familiar. Okay. I'm familiar.
So for those who are my age or older, the talk there is TOK, not TALK. It's a subculture on it's a channel, but also it's an account, but also a subculture on TikTok. And basically, it is it's a pipeline for amplifying, you know, the personalities in the book porn world. And again, book porn not being the sort of imagery that pornography, you know, the word pornography brings to mind, but the evolution of what used to be called the bodice ripper, which was basically rape fantasies for women that starred, you know, relatable women and hunky men as personified by a model from the 80s, a guy named Fabio. Do you know about Fabio?
Yes, I do know. Fabio.
Anyway, the genre has moved on from there and fused with some science fiction, but mostly fantasy. And also the 50 Shades of Grey turning point has really just shifted the whole thing in a very BDSM direction. You know, it's far more prevalent in book porn and, you know, like book talk than you would imagine, like looking at the covers or just reading summaries of these things. The summations from the publishers are often, you know, there's a wink and a nudge, or there's some coded language. I mean, they don't present themselves to the uninformed the way they do to people looking for a particular experience from their books. It is an odd phenomenon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't want to dunk on romanticism too hard because I feel like,
oh, don't worry,
just,
I'll do
you
it.
You know, kind of easy to do. But because, like, you know, I think that you know, there is variation within romanticism. Like, you know, not all romanticism is just like, you know, part erotica. I would also say that, you know, this is not a new phenomenon at all, right? Like, you know, these sort of like trashy romance books have always been popular. But like you said, what is different is that they have a much more, like, you know, innocuous like presentation to a person who doesn't know much about it. And I think especially like as different demographics drift apart, you know, in terms of what they consume, people are way less tuned in into what this stuff actually is. You know, like I assume people on Substack, you know, surely know all about romanticism and its perils, like after the last discourse cycle. But if I talk to like my average guy friend who has just like not cracked open a book for fun in a while, they're not going to know what like A Court of Thorns and Roses is. Like, they're just not going to know anything about this. And yeah, I mean, I think this is not such a good precedent. Like, I think that we should be honest about what it is that we're reading. And of course people can enjoy things, but yeah, I think that there should definitely be more stigma towards this sort of thing. Like, I remember I mean, that's basically all I have to say about that.
I have nothing against people reading what they want to read in order to get a particular sensation that they're looking for. That's fine. I mean, that's what everybody does. You know, some people they're searching for something that I appreciate, and some people are searching for something that I don't appreciate. What irritates me is that science fiction and fantasy have been joined at the hip my whole life, and the fantasy, and in particular fantasy aimed at women, portion of that genre is crowding out everything else. So if romanticism didn't grow at the expense of speculative fiction, I would say, you know, go with God, I wish you well, enjoy. But given that it's a zero-sum competition with my genre, I'm antagonistic towards romanticism.
Yeah, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot. Because I think, like, on some level, I think that having this blend of fantasy and science fiction makes sense. Like, I mean, if you've ever read Ursula K. Le Guin, it's just like, yeah, it makes sense that you can join fantasy and science fiction in these interesting ways. But I do agree, you know, like we're kind of in this golden age of fantasy in terms of popularity. I don't think, like, I don't know if fantasy novels have ever been as popular as they currently are. Like, I mean, it's one of the last genres that people still read a lot of. like, I would certainly say that fantasy is the most widely read genre in my age group. Besides like maybe some form of nonfiction. But yeah, like at the same time, the sort of really hard conceptual science fiction has kind of been pushed to the side. And I feel like it's not even about like a lack of works, but it's sort of a lack of institutional support. Like if you look at, you know, the mainstream sci-fi awards, for example, it used to be that, yeah, these awards were given to speculative fiction. You know, they could theoretically be given to fantasy or science fiction or whatever, but they used to award a very particular type of novel. And I would say nowadays, the types of novels that they award are quite different. You know, like it used to be that they would award books that were more kind of like coming out of this more pulpy magazine scene and often had these like crazy novel ideas that like nobody had seen before. Whereas nowadays it's much more common for just kind of like a, like, you know, the hot fantasy book of the year to be nominated. And I think that's fine and great, but like for fantasy to get that kind of recognition, but there isn't really like a counterpart, you know, like where is the award for the more hard sci-fi, like publication of the year? Like, where is the magazine that focuses on this type of science fiction? Where is the publishing house? And the consolidation in publishing is really prominent in like the Hugo Awards. Like if you look at the Hugo Awards, for best novel, it's basically just, the Tor, which is a sci-fi publishing house that is itself part of another bigger publishing house that just basically pats itself on the back and wins over and over and over. I think it's been quite a long time since the winner of best novel has not been a product of Tor. And I think that's sad. You know, I think that there should be this diversity in publishing and this diversity in what sorts of genres get awarded by both awards and the market. But I see it as an institutional problem first and foremost.
Well, I directed us away from politics into science fiction, and we've talked about the politics of science fiction. So let's redirect even harder into the science fiction territory, just science fiction for its own sake. Mm-hmm. You read it on the page. You haven't been doing it as long as I have, so you have a, you know, the things that you have read and which have made a strong impression on you are probably going to be different, but also I'm imagining some overlap. So what are the big, big names, you know, either titles or authors for you in print science fiction?
In print science fiction? Yeah. So let's see. I mean, I think that for me, Asimov is probably the most like influential sort of, but I see Asimov's greatest achievements as being more of like a kind of like curator community figure type person. That's honestly, like, I would say that when I look at the course of science fiction, I find myself being much more drawn to people who play to sort of like curator or editor role. I think that, like, to me, those are the people who really shape the direction of science fiction, you know, like Campbell and like Bova and Ellison, you know, people who were trying to intentionally direct science fiction a certain direction. But I feel like that's not exactly what you were asking. I think in terms of the more foundational authors, I mean, Ursula K. Le Guin, certainly. Neal Stephenson, Frank Herbert. I wish I had some kind of list in front of me.
Well, I'm glad you don't. I'm glad that, you know, the titles you're naming are having to struggle to the surface.
Right. I mean, certainly Ray Bradbury. I mean, maybe Ray Bradbury more than anyone else. Arthur C. Clarke. In the 2010s, I would say definitely Shishun Liu. Definitely, I think definitely The Broken Earth deserves mention, even though it's sort of half fantasy, by N.K. Jemisin. Book of the New Sun by Gene Wolfe stands out to me as being important. I would also say, William Gibson, obviously, although I haven't really read that much of his work. I would say that I probably know more about like the relative reputations of authors and like why they're significant than I am having like firsthand experience reading their novels, which I think is kind of something that should be fixed. But most of the engagement that I've had with reading science fiction has been either short stories or reading web fiction, which I would definitely consider to be part of science fiction, but it's certainly like a much different territory and not really related to, as related to the question that you're asking. I don't know if that's exactly the response you were looking for, but that's what I can think of so far. A lot of people that came out of the Pacific Northwest as well, you know, like Greg Bear, Octavia Butler, Ted Chiang, Ken Liu. I mean, Ken Liu's from Boston, but forgot Ted Chiang. Yeah, I mean, I think Ted Chiang is probably one of the most significant science fiction authors writing today.
Ursula K. Le Guin as well was from Oregon, or at least she lived in Oregon late in her life.
Right, for sure.
But must have been earlier too, because like The Lathe of Heaven, I think is set in the Pacific Northwest. So yeah, I didn't have an answer in mind. I just wanted to, you know, have you name some things. You know, you mentioned Asimov up front, and I read and enjoyed Asimov's, you know, his robot novels and short stories. But there's an unfortunate phenomenon of, you know, people who consider themselves to be erudite science fiction aficionados. When other people ask them, you know, where do I start? They say, oh, you got to read the Foundation Trilogy. And the Foundation Trilogy is just so boring and dry. And I cringed at the thought of people who were willing to give science fiction a chance. And somebody said, yeah, start with this. And they read like, you know, three or four chapters and they're like, eh, I don't think so. You know, when you could have given them Greg Bear, you know, you could have given them William Gibson. Go ahead.
Oh yeah. I mean, I certainly wouldn't recommend Asimov as a first science fiction novel to read. I mean, I think that, you know, nowadays I think that Asimov's shortcomings as a writer are more apparent nowadays. Like I think that you can say what you will about the changes in science fiction, but I think that it's fair to say that since Asimov wrote, science fiction writers are now expected to be much better character writers. Like, there are very few characters in Foundation that I can really remember in any way. And I think that they are also incentivized to be, like, you know, much, much better prose stylists. Maybe not much better than they were in, like, the 80s or 90s, but certainly better than when Foundation was coming out. And I think if you read Foundation now, like, especially if you're someone who kind of just like, you know, pines for the glory days of science fiction, it's kind of a reminder that like, okay, well, but there are also some ways in which this genre has improved. I actually didn't find Foundation to be, well, I mean, okay, the later books are not as interesting, but I found Foundation to be pretty interesting. But I mean, yeah, it's certainly not something that I would recommend at first to anyone.
Well, you mentioned that his characters aren't that memorable. Part of that is just the structure of Foundation. There are jumps of hundreds of years where the characters from the previous chapter are dead. You know, they lived their whole lives and died a natural death. And now you've got new people. And you've got recorded messages from Harry Seldon, you know, addressing people in ways that are increasingly detached from the reality of their situation as his prognostications have gone off the rails, or, you know, how reality has gone off the rails from his mathematically pure prognostications. And when Apple TV turned that series into a TV show, you know, a big budget prestige TV show, they had to fix that. You had to have recurring characters that, you know, you would cast for multiple seasons and would bring people back, you know, to see what happened to those characters. So you couldn't do this. Hey, yeah, we're going to jump ahead to the next crisis. And it's a whole different cast of characters who are dealing with it. You know, so they've introduced longevity and time travel and uploaded minds and, you know, all of these tricks basically to have the same four or five characters interacting with each other over many centuries. Oh, and also the cloned emperors, which is not from the books, but I thought that was the best addition for the TV show, was the tripart emperor who is child, adult, and old man simultaneously.
I mean, the Foundation, adapting Foundation was certainly an interesting choice. I was pretty into the first few episodes of the TV show, especially with the Clone Emperor thing, like you mentioned. But yeah, I mean, I kind of did lose some interest. I think that, it was always going to be difficult. I mean, I guess I do appreciate the effort. I think it's cool that someone tried to adapt Foundation, as difficult as that seems.
And understanding, I mean, I cannot fault them for departing from Asimov's method of just scrapping your entire cast of characters with each vignette. That just doesn't fly in prestige TV. You can't spend as much money as they've spent visualizing something that doesn't have a recurring cast.
For sure.
Well, since we're on prestige TV and I'll say sci-fi, I'm not sure if what I'm thinking of now counts as speculative fiction, but I've been watching Severance. And just from a sociological or economic perspective, Severance is got a fascinating premise. You know, there's an operation that somebody can undergo that splits their personality in two, and the personality that is at work doesn't remember what happened at work when they go home, and the the person at work doesn't really know the details of their life outside of work. So if you agree to undergo this procedure, you know that you're either going to wake up at work and you can never leave, or if you do quit and leave work, then you effectively die, or you're going to be on perpetual paid vacation. You know, what a choice, but really both things are going to happen. You know, both experiential branches will be taken, and maybe, you know, does the question, which one will be me, make any sense? Is it even, you know, a viable question? So these are like speculative, this is the meat for speculative experimentation, like thought experiments, but it doesn't feel like science fiction to me. I wonder, first, have you seen it? And two, you know, where would you place it in terms of its relation to the science fiction genre?
I've seen a few episodes of Severance. It's been a little bit of time. But I mean, I would certainly classify Severance as science fiction. Although I would say that as a general rule, I'm pretty liberal with assigning genre labels. I'm pretty willing to assign like a wide range of genre labels to certain, you know, many things. But yeah, I guess what made it feel not science fiction to you?
Well, it just seems to have a whole lot more in common with, say, Twin Peaks than it does with Altered Carbon. You know, it's very interested in style and tone. And there, other than the Severance procedure, there is no technological difference between the worlds of that show and our world, except that when the characters go to work, they're using very, very old technology. Like, they have computers, but they're big fat CRTs, you know, and big clicky keyboards. And do they even have mice? Not sure. But it's, you know, it's old tech, like, you know, phones with cords. And so in terms of just visualizing how the world would be transformed by scientific and technological advancement, Severance isn't really interested. It's got its one thing that it's interested in. It's kind of like, what was that movie? Brainstorm, which kind of got remade as Strange Days. The idea that you can record experience on hard media and then share it with other people. And, you know, if that happened, so many other technological developments would go hand in hand with that. And these films are just not interested in exploring, you know, a systemic upgrade of technological capabilities. They're just interested in this one tweak. But the tweak is impossible because it involves, you know, a huge leap in technological capabilities that isn't spread around. You know, that the implications of that leap are not explored. And, you know, this is, to me, the difference between Hollywood writers dabbling in science fiction concepts and people who, you know, are primarily science fiction authors who might get the chance to do big budget TV and movies.
Right. I mean, it kind of reminds me of this one time on the podcast, we were talking to one of my, my friends, and he was basically saying that the thing that most distinguishes hard science fiction, so to speak, is the degree to which it takes its premises to its logical conclusion, rather than deploying a certain level of like technological specificity. And I thought that was like an interesting way to frame it. Like, he was saying that, you know, a fantasy story that takes its like its economics very, very seriously is much more hard to him than just like a very kind of loose story that just happens to be set in space with spaceships. And I do think that this style over substance is a point of tension in a lot of things, but yeah, like, I think that science fiction nowadays has become more of an aesthetic than like a vision, I guess. Like, I think people are more interested generally in adopting a science fiction aesthetic than imagining the than using it as a tool to imagine the future. I think they're both present, but I think that in some sense, the people who created the foundations of science fiction were too successful. They created an aesthetic they created a wide array of aesthetics that were so compelling that they kind of became compelling on their own without like a speculative component. And so I think that's where questions of genre start to get really interesting. Like, if you have a story that is really grounded in the aesthetics of science fiction, like it has spaceships and it has like robots, but at the same time it just has all the trappings of like a fantasy novel or a fantasy adventure, like, is it sci-fi, is it fantasy, who knows?
Yeah, and to some extent, you know, the distinctions between science fiction and fantasy, they're arbitrary. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to speculative fiction, yeah, I you can have speculative fiction in a like high fantasy setting if you are really going to drill down on the implications of, say, your economic system, or if you know you want to be like, I've seen YouTube videos examining the military implications of dragons in Game of Thrones. Like, you have a medieval setting, but you have air power. And you have the ability to bombard, you know, fortified positions from the air with fire that is so hot it melts stone. I mean, that totally changes the way that you deploy military force or you project military force. And if only one side has dragons, you know, then there's, I don't know that George R. R. Martin, or even more so the TV producers, Benioff and Weiss, really had that in mind and were, you know, rigorously drilling down on it. But you could. You could, and you could have some speculative fantasy, although I haven't seen much of it, just, you know, to be honest. One of my favorite series is The Book of the New Sun. So I was happy to hear you list it as being prominent for you. How old were you when you first read it, and what was your experience of getting into it?
I mean, I first read The Book of the New Sun very recently, like in the past year. I would say that... Well, The Book of the New Sun was recommended very highly by pretty much every critic of science fiction and fantasy, as well as like a couple of my friends. I would say that it's not really my type of book. I think that the amount that I thought it was good was much better than the amount that I enjoyed the reading experience. But I did just really appreciate the sheer ambition required to produce such a work. Like, I mean, sometimes I was just reading it and I was just like, man, I'm kind of surprised this ever was written at all.
or published.
I mean, yeah, or published. But I, you know, I mean, it was a different time. I think that honestly, yeah, I did actually write an article about Book of the New Sun on the Substack, where I was basically contending that Book of the New Sun, one of the reasons that it's not really remembered as much today in the mainstream, even though it's so highly regarded within sci-fi circles and fantasy circles, is that the culture is just sort of moving away from the sort of culture in which Book of the New Sun would have been the most relevant. I think Book of the New Sun even came out a bit late if we're trying to assess like when it would have had maximum impact. Like, I think if Book of the New Sun came out around the time that like Lord of the Rings was being published and Narnia was being published and was just sort of embedded in this more like, you know, scholarly Christian culture, I think it really could have had like a much bigger impact. But I think that in a world where we are just so much like less literate about Christianity in particular as a culture, and there's not as many of these like cultural anchors that we can reliably point to, a lot of the Book of the New Sun just kind of is confusing or unknowable. I think that something that I think about a lot is that so much of consuming media is related to these sorts of cultural anchors that you have as a society at a given time. And there are many works in the past that we can understand on some level, but we can never truly understand to the same degree that someone reading it in that time would have, because there are certain cultural anchors that are just implicit and unknowable. And I think that we can kind of see that happening to the Book of the New Sun, where I feel like every decade that passes, we move further away from like the culture that would have best understood what this novel was trying to say. And you can obviously study these things, but I think that, the further we move away from it, the further the more difficult it is to kind of like like understand it without a serious work on the reader's end.
So the last thing you said there is very important about Book in the New Sun. It does. It is a high effort read. It asks a lot of the reader, and not all of Gene Wolfe's fiction is like that. He wrote a series of books about a Roman soldier in ancient Greece who, you know, it's basically Memento, but in a, you know, antique setting. And so this character, his name is Latro, and he forgets what's happened to him. And the book that you're reading is his diary that he's writing for himself to remind him of who the people around him are and what the currents in his life is and what he's supposed to be doing. And he can't reread the whole thing every day because so it's gotten so long. So it's inconsistent with itself. You can see that he's making errors, like he's reporting things as fact, which you, the reader, know are not true. But it doesn't have the recondite vocabulary of Book of the New Sun, and it doesn't hide its... It doesn't hide its setting like Book of the New Sun does. You know, I've talked to people who said, yeah, I started to read that, but I don't like fantasy, so I didn't stick with it. And it's like, well, Book of the New Sun is, I don't know if you could call it hard sci-fi. It's definitely science fiction, though. I mean, it takes place possibly millions of years in the future. The sun is going out, but, you know, it's definitely a high-tech setting. It's just most of the people don't understand the technology or really have access to it. You've mentioned it in the term in the context of Christian literature. And Gene Wolfe, you know, he came to his Catholicism late in life. He converted after he married. And you can read the Book of the New Sun and never know that it's Christian literature. It's certainly not, you know, it's not Narnia. It doesn't have Aslan. You know, it doesn't have these obvious stand-ins for Christian characters, although almost all of the characters that you meet are named after Catholic saints, but probably Catholic saints you've never heard of. But it is a very dense and layered book. And I read it the first time in the late 90s when I was in my late 20s. And, you know, reading it at first, the first few pages were kind of off-putting, but then something clicked. It's like, oh, this is real. There's a reality being described here that it's, you know, there's a reason for this impenetrability. And if I push through it, you know, it's not James Joyce, but it's certainly not, you know, like Frederick Pohl or Robert Heinlein. I mean, it takes some work to get at it. But I read it to myself. And then a couple years later, I read it aloud to the woman who would become my wife. And then I read it again several years after that. And then in the last few years, I've listened to the audiobooks because there's some excellent productions of it available on Audible. And then I listened to a podcast series about it. I mean, I've delved into it in different ways, you know, coming at it from different angles over a course of decades. And I think I've gotten to the point where I've pretty much gotten out of it what there is to get. But you're not going to get it on one read for sure. I mean, you'll get something. There's a lot there, but you won't really unpack the Book of the New Sun on one read. And, you know, you probably won't unpack it on two reads unless there's many years between and some additional work done. Not to go off on such a tangent in terms of Gene Wolfe and the Book of the New Sun. I think the thing I most want to get to with it is that when I first read it, there was an experiential payoff that, you know, I've looked to other books to try to recreate and haven't. But, you know, I don't want to bring it back to romanticism in any lasting way, but if somebody got a particular feeling from a book that they, you know, that feeling was rewarding and they wanted to get it again from a different book, go with God, you know, good luck. I totally understand and approve of your quest and I wish you the best. I'm probably not going to read the books that you're going to read, but I wish you the best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that honestly, I would say that, Book of the New Sun was probably less novel to me than it was for you, in that two of my favorite sci-fi, I guess these were both science fantasy works, I would say do borrow from it. Like they are similar in some sense.
What are they?
I mean, the biggest example is like the Broken Earth trilogy by N.K. Jemisin. Have you read this before?
I have not read any N.K. Jemisin. I've seen her books on the shelf at the library, but I have not delved into them.
Right. So the Broken Earth, it's definitely like less ambitious, but it is set in this world where people are like living on the bones of these dead civilizations and don't really understand the technology that has made their world. And as you go through the universe of the novel, you realize the truth of some of these technologies. It tells you things a lot more, like it's a much more accessible novel. I mean, it's hard to not be more accessible than the Book of the New Sun, I think. But like, you know, you do capture some of that novel feeling of like having the feeling of seeing like a this dead civilization and then this more modern, more primitive one sitting on the top of it is just this really novel experience. I remember when I first read the story, it's just like, wow, this is so cool. I want to see how much other dead civ literature there's out there. And there's really not that much of it. Like I was kind of expecting this to be this whole booming genre that's not really there. But I would say that the I would highly recommend that series. But I think that the other book that it did remind me of somewhat is this very kind of pulpy web serialized novel called the Flower That Bloomed Nowhere, which is just very like. I don't exactly know how to describe the similarity, but it does give you the similar sense of being like weirdly suspended in like time and space and things happening on like these drastic time scales that are difficult for you to comprehend. It's a very interesting novel, if you can call it that, but I would say those evoke some similar feelings as well. And these were just like so resonant for me and core to my experience of reading science fiction that like, yeah, I couldn't help but be reminded of those things. But I think that the component that I did get from Book of the New Sun was actually this like the Christian component, honestly. Like I feel like the subtlety with which the Book of the New Sun treats Christianity is part of what makes it so much harder to read in the modern age. Like if you don't have like a pretty strong background in not only Christianity, but just like Christian scholarship, I feel like you're going to get a lot less out of it. And it's not even necessarily obvious what you should be looking to learn. You know, it's like, you can't really just, you're not going to learn that much cultural information for the sake of just reading like one book. Right. I guess if you'll allow me, I want to read like this interesting thing that Gene Wolfe wrote about, the Book of the New Sun that sort of gets at like what I'm trying to say.
Go for it.
He wrote, "It has been remarked thousands of times that Christ died under torture. Many of us have read so often that he was a humble carpenter that we feel a little surge of nausea on seeing the words again. But no one ever seems to notice that the instruments of torture were wood, nails, and a hammer, that the man who built the cross was undoubtedly a carpenter too. The man who hammered in the nails is as much a carpenter as a soldier, as much a carpenter as a torturer. Very few seem even to have noticed that although Christ was a humble carpenter, the only object we are specifically told he made was not a table or a chair, but a whip. And if Christ knew not only the pain of torture, but the pain of being a torturer, as it seems certain to me that he did, the dark figure is also capable of being a heroic and even a holy figure." Like that sort of stuff, like it's just so like it's very interesting, very, very interesting and insightful, but so much of it hinges on the premise the reader is very familiar with Christianity. Like there's this part where he says, many of us have read so often that he was a humble carpenter that we feel a little surge of nausea. I think there are plenty of people in Gen Z, like in the US who just like haven't like aren't that familiar with that phrase, but like he's asserting that like, oh yeah, you've heard this phrase so much you must be tired of it. And a lot of things in the Book of the New Sun are like that. I think like it assumes a level of engagement with Christianity from the reader that is becoming increasingly rare.
Have you seen The Last Temptation of Christ?
I have not seen The Last Temptation of Christ.
For those who don't remember, it's a film from the 80s. It's by Martin Scorsese. Who played the Green Goblin? Just kind of blanking on this guy's name. He was in The Lighthouse. I mean, he's been in a million things. Willem Dafoe plays Christ. And in the very beginning of the film, he is working on a cross for the Romans. And Judas, played by Harvey Keitel, comes to tell him, you know, why are you making crosses for the Romans?
You're a disgrace! The Romans can't find anybody to make crosses except for you! You do it! You're worse than them! You're a Jew killing Jews! You're a coward!
This is, the idea that Christ built implements of torture and was later, you know, executed using them, is not something that is unique to Wolf. But as you say, yeah, it is an idea that is not current in contemporary, you know, pulp or pop culture or literary fiction that, you know, people under, say, the age of 35 would be familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that it's not just about the decline of Christianity, but the particular way in which Christianity has declined. Like, I think that, you know, in the mid 20th century, there was just a lot of brain drain out of Christianity. You know, like a lot of the people who might have been like theologians or religious scholars in like a past era were, you know, drifting more towards like the sciences. And so I feel like the way in which Christianity decline was most pronounced among, like, you know, the scholars and the elite. And I think that this really affected the perception of Christianity for people like myself who are older, who have like only really, who like primarily engaged with Christianity in like its sort of like less scholarly, more like rural based form, which is just like a lot less intellectually compelling. And I think that, honestly, I think this is starting to change a bit. Like, I do think you're starting to see a little bit of, like, you know, intellectually inclined young people turning towards Christianity at the grassroots. But I think, you know, even now, I think that the mainstream impression of Christianity in America is just the sort of, like, you know, brain drained, less intellectually vital one, because it's just been so long since we were in the era of, like, you know, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton.
Have you read any Ian M. Banks?
I've read The Algebraist only.
Oh, that's a good one, I have to say. The Algebraist doesn't, it's not one of his culture novels, but it takes place in the same setting pretty much. Like, at one point, there's a reference to different types of, you know, social and political forms, and he mentions cultures, plural. But yeah, it is a, you know, it is space opera. Main character is, he goes to a lot of different places, has a lot of very, you know, strange experiences, you know, exotic experiences with aliens. Like, you know, some of the aliens in The Algebraist live inside of gas giants like Jupiter. And he wears a space suit that is also a spaceship, you know, that he goes down. It's like an Iron Man suit, but sort of like manta ray-ish. And he spends a lot of time inside a gas giant interacting with these, what do they call them? Delvers? What were the gas giant?
Oh, dwellers.
The dwellers.
Yes.
But he's written a whole series called the Culture Series, which is basically, you know, the notion of fully automated luxury or communism is embodied in the Culture Series. Like, the culture is this enormous, and like trillions of citizens. It's run by minds, which is to say artificial intelligences, which are wholly benevolent to the culture citizens, but which are pretty Machiavellian and morally gray when it comes to dealing with outside, you know, polities and forces. And most of the books involve their version of the CIA, which they call special circumstances. And special circumstances, people get up to some very, you know, unculture-like activities. But there is material abundance. There is maximum freedom, minimal rules, absolute total gender equality. Culture citizens can change gender at will. It takes a few months, but there's no operation. It's not like it's something being done to you. You just decide, and your body transitions over to the other sex for as long as you care to. And so, you know, culture citizens can both father and mother children. They probably could clone themselves. I mean, the options for how you want to live your life are, you know, they're huge. It's a myriad of options. So he's extremely left and progressive, but he was writing in the 80s and the 90s before the current era of like totalitarian progressivism, where there's nothing obnoxious about his presentation of a very far left worldview. Whereas if somebody tried to, you know, write this from a left or progressive perspective for the left, you know, for a left audience, it would be very heavy-handed today, and just, you know, from my perspective, unreadable. But even though I'm not progressive and I'm not on the political left, I still absolutely love the culture novels. And everything, really, that I've read from Ian M. Banks, even though his politics are not my politics. So it seems like there's a way of engaging politically in a very substantial way that Ian M. Banks had mastered, which is either beyond the capabilities or just beyond the desires of the current crop of writers and, I guess, publishers as well.
Mm-hmm. I think really it's kind of beyond the crop of desires. I think that's really more the problem. I think that if you write a novel like that is countercultural, you know, like the culture was at the time, you can't afford to be didactic. You know, no one would read it. I actually have a post on this very subject. It was one of the more recent posts about The Broken Earth, actually, by N.K. Jemisin, and it was talking about how this is actually a pretty good example of someone like using a novel series as like a vehicle for progressive ideology without being overly didactic. But you know, I think that since then, I don't think N.K. Jemisin continued to write in that direction, really. And I think it's partially because I don't think that's what audiences want. Like, I don't really think that. Like, I mean, like, honestly, like, a lot of people, like, and I'm not even trying to knock this necessarily, but I think a lot of people try to read novels for escapism and catharsis. And a lot of people just want their current views to just be validated in a very heavy-handed way. Like, a lot of people really enjoyed watching Mickey 17 because it kind of just gave very, like, uncomplicated voice to their concerns. And so I think that in order for that type of style to, like, in order for that, for people to write in this way, I think that the novel either needs to be less of the mainstream culture, or there needs to be an appetite for engaging with stuff like that. And I think that, yeah, like, I think that there isn't really a ton of appetite for nuance in this way. Like, I think it's less that authors are unable to do so, and it's more like they don't really have an incentive to.
Do you know the history of how Ian M. Banks got published?
I do not, actually.
It's pretty funny. He wanted to write science fiction, and he didn't have any luck breaking into science fiction, so he decided to write literary fiction. And he wrote a novel called The Wasp Factory, which is not science fiction, and it did very well. And he used his newfound success and celebrity as a literary author to write science fiction. And he didn't write, you know, ponderous, weighty, speculative fiction. He wrote fun space opera. But, you know, his culture books, maybe by now they've outsold his literary works, but when he was writing them, he could have been making a lot more money and selling a lot more books, writing stuff, you know, for the New York Times bestseller list. And you know, he was taking a hit in terms of his earning potential by writing space opera, but it's what he loved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's pretty funny. I certainly respect that.
Well, we are pretty near the end here, so let me just throw it open to you. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about or any subject that you wanted to touch on that we haven't gotten around to?
Right. Yeah. So thanks for having me on. I guess like a kind of theme that we've been dancing around is that I really think that the current vibe shift against wokeness or whatever you want to call it has paradoxically led to a much greater appetite for genuine diversity. I think that a lot of media that's being pushed today is like fake diversity. You know, like it's diverse in the sense that, you know, people may be like eating different types of food or something like that. Like, you know, modern day authors love to talk about different kinds of like ethnic food. But it doesn't actually involve like any real sort of like intellectual diversity. And I think that like, you know, the vast majority of stuff that's published today is the ideology of people who do like MFA programs at Ivy League schools. Like that is just the worldview that happens. And it's not really shared by the vast majority of the culture. And so when you read books like The Book of the New Sun, it really gets you thinking about like, wow, what would a really vital literary landscape look like where you have this true intellectual diversity, like people that really just have a totally different worldview for how the thing should be and how the world works. I think that is actually what makes Cixin Liu the Chinese author so important? Have you read Xi Shen Liu before, Three Body Problem?
I watched both the Chinese and the Netflix adaptations, you know, TV adaptations of it, but I've not read the original novels.
Mm-hmm. So I would highly recommend the Three Body Problem series, in particular the last book. It's very like heady and hard sci-fi. But I think that another thing to appreciate about it is that it is just so, like, it is truly from a different culture. You know, it was published originally in Chinese and it was just not written for American audiences. And you can tell there are just certain things and assumptions that there may be like hard to put your finger on exactly, but you read the book and you're just like, yeah, I can tell this came from someone who has like a totally different non-Western worldview. And that is quite interesting. You know, it's much more genuine diversity than like, you know, a Chinese American who was raised in the suburbs and did an MFA at Yale, you know? And so I think that I guess as an example of what I'm talking about, there's a pretty strong focus on this idea of like humanity's oneness, you know, like the importance of not having humanity be split up into these separate parts. And I think this is like a pretty integral component of like the Chinese worldview and like how China is to be and how civilization is to be. This is really difficult to articulate to like a Westerner. It's something that I still haven't quite wrapped my head around. And I think this is also central to the Taiwan question and stuff like that. But it's just like, it was something that I don't think I understood quite well enough to articulate to someone, but I understood it well enough to be like, okay, this is why this particular focus is there. So anyway, I think that I really hope that we see like, you know, a greater, like a proliferation of intellectual diversity in media, which I don't know. I could go either way on whether I expect this to happen. I'm not particularly optimistic, but I think it could happen. Yeah, I think that with greater intellectual diversity, like better science fiction will follow.
So here's a hopeful note on which to end. Andy Weir wrote The Martian, and mm-hmm. it's excellent, but it's definitely very, you know, a nerdy white guy science fiction as physics problem solving exercise, and no publisher would touch it. So he self-published on Amazon. Mm-hmm. Sold a bunch of copies, and publishers decided, you know what, we'd like to make money from this thing, which is already selling, so let's buy it. And it, you know, got made into a film directed by Ridley Scott. So it happens. You know, you can call it a Horatio Alger story, which is the exception, which, you know, makes the unpalatable rule acceptable to the hopeful. But, you know, it is possible. It is possible for good science fiction to get through the filters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And like, honestly, like, I think that the points that are being brought up right now are just like, they would have been most salient and urgent like 10 years ago. I think, you know, there's like a process by which these things trickle down. And I think now, like, the direction of these things has already kind of shifted, you know? And so I think that I feel like this is something that I don't feel particularly like, I guess, sort of like puritanical ideology in publishing. It's like something that I'm not as pressed about because I just feel like things are already moving with the culture that it's just not going to be as salient as it once was. And I also think that market forces are going to shape things in a similar way. Like, I ultimately think that market forces basically determine all of the action of these conglomerates, like almost all of them. And so I think that because we're seeing this vibe shift, I don't really expect this to be like nearly as much of a concern as it was in the past, like, you know, 5 or 10 years or so. Although I could certainly be surprised. So we'll have to see what happens.
Well, the personnel in publishing aren't going to shift as rapidly as, you know, the vibes of the culture in general. They're kind of like the Supreme Court. They're an ideological anchor that is going to lag.
Well, I mean, they could be fired by the, like, you know, the Wall Street CEOs have said, giant megacorps.
Yeah, but, you know, it is like BlackRock and other private equity and financial institutions that are allowing companies like Disney to lose money hand over fist year after year in pursuit of ideological purity. So, I mean, the progressive orthodoxy has significant financial backing, which is it is not as susceptible to supply and demand and profit as you might think in a society like ours, which is so, you know, aggressively capitalistic.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, I certainly think that, like, you know, this sort of media will continue to come out, but I think that, you know, I think the market will respond to, like, an appetite for these other things. I mean, I've been pretty struck by just how quickly things have shifted, at least it seeming to me, just, like, you know, from my, just, like, anecdotally from being, like, on the ground, I guess, how people's views have changed, how in particular, how young people's views have changed. So, I don't know. I think it's hard to say what will come next, but I think that the flashpoints in, the culture war, I suppose, are definitely going to be much different in the near future.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, Kevin, your Substack and podcast again are what?
SynthesizedSunsets.substack.com.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It was good talking to you.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. That was Kevin of the Synthesized Sunsets magazine, Substack, and podcast. And reading from the description of the Substack, it says, Synthesized Sunsets is a Seattle mag about speculative fiction and the future of pop. Every quarter will bring a new season of the magazine, which will feature a print edition and an aesthetic theme to guide the articles for that season. Speculative fiction is meant in the broadest possible sense. Anything involving future visions or distant worlds is fair game. Each issue will cover a wide range of media, including literature, film, and web fiction. In addition to critical content, we will also publish short fiction written by Seattle writers. If you would like to submit a piece, please send an email to synthesizedsunsets@substack.com with the subject line, Fiction Submission. Anyway, it goes on, but rather than read it to you, I will just direct you to that Substack. If you are listening to this via Substack, well, then it'll be very easy to find, but if not, you're going to have to do some typing. Again, it is Synthesized Sunsets. And of course, we were talking about science fiction, and I should, if I know what's good for me, at every opportunity, remind people that I have written a science fiction novel. It is called Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt, Gen X Science Fiction. It is available exclusively from Amazon, either as a Kindle or as a paperback. And to thank somebody, I don't know who it is, they identify themselves only as Amazon customer, I'm going to read a 5-star review of the book. Amazon customer writes, fiercely inventive, uninhibited, hard sci-fi that destroys old limits. Really great book. I lost a lot of sleep staying up late to binge on this. First part of the book had riveting and uninhibited world building. What would life on a long-term spaceship actually be like? And how would behavioral and sexual mores develop to fit the isolated community of a starship? How might AI change human society? And how might humanity split into different subspecies? The main characters are well-developed and thankfully not repeats of familiar tropes. But this book really kicks in when the ship reaches its destination and new, ancient life is discovered and interacted with. Brilliant writing. I'm eager for a follow-up. Well, I'm writing a follow-up, but it is a prequel rather than a sequel. I have no promised date for it, but I am working on it consistently. All right, that is all. I would direct you to my Substack. That is where the bulk of my effort goes these days that isn't fiction writing. The fiction writing is happening behind the curtain, as it were. Only to be revealed when it is ready for consumption in large chunks. All right, I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.